rarely do you get told to come over to your boss's house. You know, it's usually for one or two reasons, some good or some very bad. And I'm racking my head as to what did I do and why is he going to fire me over cookies? I'm like, well, if I'm going to get fired, I'm going to get fired on a full stomach, you know? So I start munching on cookies, and he comes in and he tells me point blank. He goes, the intel community thinks they've found bin Laden.
Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast. Real, raw, and unfiltered conversations with veterans and those who support them. Tune in, be inspired, and walk away stronger.
Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast, brought to you in partnership with our friends at Supply Chain Now. Thank you, Scott, Amanda, and gang, for allowing us to do this. And today is another great episode. We welcome a very good friend of mine. I know he's an Army veteran, but a very good friend of mine, John Thompson. Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast, John.
Thank you, Lloyd. Happy to be here. And congratulations on your new podcast.
Yeah, thanks, John. So John was keynote speaker at a Vetlanta Summit. I think it was a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. Time was just flying by. And it was really fascinating. I knew John, and I knew the story, and we're going to talk a little bit about the story for quite a while. But to hear him in public talk about it, and it's just fascinating. But before we get into the story, I just want to get into John's background. So John works for Cox Enterprises and played here in Atlanta, Georgia. But John's a Georgia native. John, where are you originally from?
Well, originally I was born at Fort Rucker as a military brat. And I unfortunately am a Gold Star son. So shortly after my dad was shot down and killed in Vietnam, my mom, sister, and myself moved back to Lincolnton, Georgia, stayed there for a little bit and until we pulled up roots and moved to Augusta. So Augusta is where I call home. That's where I went to elementary school, high school, and where most of my family still resides.
And you decided to go to UNG, so University of North Georgia. So how did that happen?
I did. I don't know whether it was much my decision as it was mom's in a very indirect way of telling me, you need to figure out what you want to do in life. And that was an option that she gave me. And it turned out to be a very good option. So, you know, when I was in high school, my grandmother handed me a letter my senior year shortly before I graduated. And it actually was a letter my dad had written me on my second birthday when I was 2 years old. And she handed it to me and said, read this, and I think it will speak to you as to, you know, what you may or may not consider you want to do, you know, from here on out. So I read it, and it even as an 18-year-old or 17 or 18-year-old back then, it was a very moving letter. And it had to sink in that a man of only at the time who was only 27 or 28 years old, 10 years older than I was at the time, wrote this very poignant letter and sort of set expectations of not only what he expected of me, but what society expected of me with whatever I chose as my occupation. And it just so happened to, turn out that, you know, I mirrored his occupation of going to North Georgia, accepting a commission in the United States Army and flying helicopters. And fortunately, I made it for 30 years, and he unfortunately only made it for 5 or 6 years.
Wow. Was he a UH-1 pilot?
His first tour in Vietnam in 63 and 64, which were considered early years, back when they flew a lot of Arvin around and advisors around, MACV, He flew the old H-21. It was called a banana boat, and it was the predecessor to the CH-47. It was a tandem rotor helicopter. He flew that during his first tour and his second tour with Charlie Troop, 1st and 9th Air Cav and 1st Air Cav Division, flew UH-1B gunships.
Wow. And if I remember right, your grandfather served as well?
He did. And although I don't know much about him, and actually that's another interesting story that we could probably divert off into. Biologically, my last name is Parker. and Robert A. Parker was a fact check me on this, but he was either a B-17 or B-29. I can't remember, but he was a bomber pilot during World War II. And the story I'm told that he went down over the Mediterranean. Wow. Don't know what years. I do need to probably dig into that a little bit more and figure out. But anyway, after he was shot down, my grandmother at the time, if you will, my biological father's mother, remarried, and they moved to Macon, Georgia. And the stepfather adopted my dad, Robert, at the time, Robert Parker, and then assumed his last name of Robert Thompson.
Wow. Man, that's just powerful. Gives me shivers.
It is eerie when you think about it. And one day I am going to dig into it to see what's there, more of what's there.
So now the UNG really worked out for you, not for the education that you got, but you met your future bride at UNG as well.
I followed suit like my dad. My dad met my mom there at North Georgia. And I did the same with Lachelle, and it was by far the best decision that I ever made. I know she questions that at some time, but we're 37 going on 38 years strong now.
Yep. So that's the best decision you've ever made. She's definitely your better half. So I love the girl. So you graduate from UNG, and then what's the next step?
So, fortunately, I got a commission into Army Aviation. How that went, I don't know. Obviously, they didn't take GPA too much into account, but I somehow found myself getting branched aviation and wound up going to Fort Rucker. But rewind 4 months into that, during my last quarter of school, a horse decided to throw me. And I busted this wrist in 14 places and was put in the cast and, several pins in my wrist, during that. And, obviously doom and gloom from the doctors, you'll never have full mobility, therefore you'll never fly and all that. And so, yes, Lachelle and I were already engaged, and I was thinking the world was coming to an end. She was thinking that, why did I choose this guy, or why did I latch myself onto this guy or not? But anyway, that being said, we showed up to Fort Rucker 24 hours before I showed up to Fort Rucker, actually wound up sawing my cast off. had already taken the pins out. The doctor had. I didn't do that. Had already taken the pins out, but he said I needed to keep the cast on, and I was like, that ain't gonna happen. I cannot report into the military with a cast on my arm. So I went down and fresh out of a cast, but the odd thing was that when I was in a cast, my hand or my wrist was cocked off like that, because your wrist is straight when your hand is pointed downwards like that instead of like this. So my hand was frozen like this pretty much. And so when I went in, I gave a salute, something to the effect like that. And I don't know whether the officer in charge or on duty was looking at me right, or, you know, didn't see me or what. If he was, he probably thought, well, we got a winner here, boys.
It reminds me a little bit of the...
Won't take long to get rid of him.
We'll send him to the Air Force. All reminds me a little bit of the story of Chuck Yeager. So the Chuck Yeager, before he broke the serum barrier, he was riding horses on a happy bottom club out in Edwards, and actually it was Muroc at the time, and got bucked and broke his ribs. And then went out the next day and actually had to, he took a sawed-off broomstick with him. So he could shut the canopy. So, yeah, pretty wild story. So you're back at the home of your dad, Fort Rucker. I just can't imagine that.
And, it was surreal. Partly because one of his classmates, actually not a classmate, but one of his good friends from school was a general officer there. A guy by the name of Marvin Michener. He was the command of the U.S. Army Safety Center at the time. And back then, as you can probably remember, dinner or brunch at the O Club or NCO Club was a pretty, traditional thing. A lot of people showed up, and, you know, General Michener invited little Second Lieutenant Thompson and Mrs. Thompson to Sunday brunch at the Fort Rucker O Club. And that was a not so fun experience. I do remember, how can a person sweat this much and, eat all you can eat eggs, waffles, he was a great guy though. Really, talked me through a lot of things. Sat down with him a few times while I was there at flight school, and just sort of was a indirect mentor, if you will, as I was there at Fort Rucker going through OBC and flight school.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm just picturing LaShelle and laughing when we're telling you that you're going to do what?
She goes, okay, what's a general?
Exactly.
And then why is it that everybody's looking at us while we're eating, it was pretty awkward.
Yep, I remember
look back and laugh.
Taking my late wife, Suzanne, to the first couple of dining outs. And I remember how nervous. I was nervous, but it was 100 pounds worse for her. So
exactly.
What it was, a pilot school, 6 months in Fort Rucker?
No, actually, we were there probably with the combination of OBC and flight school. It was around 18 months.
Wow, 18 months.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was even back in the prehistoric days with the older aircraft, many of which are in the museum now. So it was about 5 or 6 months of OBC officer basic course. And then you go into your initial training with, it was called the TH-55, but they were old Schweitzer aircraft. And the only thing I remember is that they had, it was either 10 or 11 fan belts, if you will, because it wasn't obviously a turbine engine, and it was acceptable that, two or three of them can be broken, pre-flight. so you had to have a certain number of belts that were operable and in good working condition for flight. And I do remember specifically that there was this one guy who I actually took my nickel ride with, and that is basically your first ride ever as a flight student. And he used to be, or he was at one time, Pappy Boyington's crew chief in World War II. And this guy, Lloyd, when he walked, I don't think his feet came up off the ground probably more than 2 or 3 millimeters. He shuffled. Yeah. He was all hunched over and all that. And when we were walking out to the aircraft, I was like, this guy's going to have a coronary on the way out. You know, I'm like, oh my gosh, what's going on? But when that aircraft engine started and we took off, smooth as silk.
Yeah.
I mean, he would show me things that, you know, I still haven't forgotten today. Yeah. But very effective instructor pilot, and actually got to fly with him a couple of other times before I graduated that phase of flight school training. And then when you go from there, the initial trainer, you go into Huey's, of which all your instruments are taken in. And, you know, that was a very uncomfortable feeling, as it was probably for a lot of people, because a lot of people don't consider helicopters to be hugely all-weather type of aircraft. But, you know, the Black Hawk had been in the Army inventory probably a good, you know, 7, 8, 9 years by then, taking instruments in the Huey, which was still a pretty primitive aircraft from a instrument perspective, was very humbling. I did not enjoy it. I did not enjoy flying with that hood, and was probably bopped in the head more than a few times from attempting to raise my head up and look over the instrument panel between my hood and the outside, just so I could see that, you know, one, I'm not about to hit anything, or two, that, you know, I just didn't like that locked in feeling on about anywhere from 4 to 6 analog instruments, you know, flying through the air at a, you know, 80 knots.
I vaguely remember a bad 1980s movie where that was in the movie, and the student pilot struggling, they put him in a car or a Jeep with the HUD on. But sure, I'll have to see if I can find that one out for you.
Yeah, so, what was it? It wasn't that B-rated Firebirds movie.
Yeah, that's probably what it's probably what it was.
Yeah, Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, that's what it was.
All about it's Apache pilots.
Oh, yeah, right. So it's not true. So,
yeah, everything. Everything's true in Hollywood.
So you get 18 months, you complete the pilot training. So what's your first aircraft and duty station?
Let me back up a little bit. You know, from Huey's, we went, you could go into your so-called advanced aircraft. And back then, there were Cobras, Apaches, and 58s, or you could stay in the Huey. With Dad being in the Cav, I felt that, you know, I needed to go Cav. You know, there's a whole saying out there, if you ain't Cav, you ain't, SH, you know, so. And I internalized that, you know. I already had my dad's Stetson from Vietnam, so I thought it was my destiny to be a cavalryman. So where do all good cavalrymen go in late
Fort Campbell, 80s, Fort Campbell, you know, Kentucky?
Negative. Nope. We have to go and be the speed bump between the Soviet, you know, Big Bear and all of United States Army Europe. All right. So it's either the 11th ACR or the 2nd ACR.
In Germany?
And Armored Cavalry Regiment in Germany. Yeah, so that was the place to go if you were a cavalryman, and you had to get the boots to match it as well.
All right.
So I got orders to the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, headquartered just south of Nuremberg, Germany. And we had the border. We overlapped with the 11th ACR in the north, who famously patrolled the Fulda Gap.
Yep.
Everybody knows the Fulda Gap. But what people didn't realize or don't realize is that our border sector was almost 2/3 greater than theirs, because a lot of emphasis was made on the Fulda Gap. So we had half of the East German, West German border, and all of the, at the time, Czechoslovakia border, all the way down to the Austrian border. So we patrol that 24/7.
Wow. Yeah, amazing. And how long were you there?
We were in Germany for almost 4 years. with a brief recess of Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, of which we were deployed to in December of 90.
Okay. Yep.
And we were completely caught off guard with that. There were several books written as to how all of that deployment came out. And the Corps commander at the time, General Freddie Franks, even claims to this day he found out the same way we did when Secretary of Defense Cheney announced on CNN, of which we only had one channel back then in Germany, Armed Forces Network, and they said that the Army 7th Corps was going to Desert Shield, Desert Storm.
Yeah.
And I remember being at home. Of course, it was nighttime when that announcement was made much earlier in the day back in the States. And Lachelle and I looked at each other and go, I wonder who's in 7th Corps, you know? Lieutenant Thompson didn't know, but sure enough, you know, 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment was in 7th Corps.
And,
so.
and where did you end up going?
Our port of entry was Al Jubal, in the kingdom, and we prepped our aircraft there. Then we flew, like everybody else, flew and drove down Tapline Road out to the western flank, of which, when we were set, the 101st and the 82nd, i.e. the 18th Airborne Corps, along with, at the time, 24th Infantry Division, took up the extreme western flank outside of us. So I can't remember. It was the Marine Corps on the eastern flank. 7th Corps had the middle, 1st MEF, 2nd MEF. I can't remember. Poor historian. And then the 18th Airborne Corps with the Allied forces were on the extreme western flank.
Wow. And how long were you feed dry?
So we deployed on the 6th of December, and we were home April, early April.
Okay.
So it was like right about 5 months-ish, right. You know?
Yep, I was flying 141 Skylifters, and I got to come home every 2 or 3 weeks, which was nice, but it was the most flying I did in my entire 20-year career. It was just it was just back and forth from the U.S. to the Middle East to Europe, but a little bit of everywhere, actually. And how many, can we talk about how many assets, how many helicopters did your unit have out there?
So yeah, I was a scout platoon leader at the time in a armored cavalry regiment, and the task organization back then was 858 and 6 Cobras per troop.
Okay,
and I think the cav troops may have been reverse that. No, I think I was right. 858 and 6 Cobras per troop. And again, I was a 58 platoon leader. A good friend of mine, Heath Williams, who, you know, works up here at UNG right now, was the Cobra platoon leader. As doctrine would dictate, we were the eyes and ears of the 7th Corps. We pushed out over the berm before everybody else, did such a fast sprint up through one Republican Guard division. Don't remember the exact nomenclature of them, but on G+3, Ground+3, got weathered in. And I want to say that was around the same timing of the Battle of the 73 Easting, of which is documented in several books. General H.R. McMaster was decorated during that time frame, won a Silver Star. But that was in the middle of the Republican Guard Tawakana division. And actually, I have a print up here on my office wall. It's called Tawakana Sunset.
All right.
And it's layered four very different type of scenes. And one of them is a massive storm, if you will. So a shamal, which was a sandstorm, you know, in addition to thunder and lightning and rain, of which we were literally shut down or grounded, I want to say for at least, you know, 12, probably 15 or at least 18 hours where we could not see outside of our aircraft. That's how bad the weather was. And there's really no more vulnerable feeling than, you know, not being able to much less see when you're flying outside of your aircraft, but imagine sitting on the ground and not being, you know, able to see and knowing that there are tank squadrons and heavy equipment, you know, just rolling all around you.
In a future episode, we'll have one of my other good friends, Command Sergeant Major Roger Rowley, talk about that storm. He was in that battle, and he talks about the storm was so bad, they were parked next to, you know, the Republican Guard tanks, and it was, it's like horrifying. So,
well, it turns out that we were actually grounded in the middle of one of the Republican Guard's assembly areas. Obviously, it was after they had abandoned it and either, you know, fled north or fled south and surrendered. But sure enough, we got out and we discovered bunkers and crates of unused weapons, unused uniforms. I mean, it was crazy.
Wow. That is crazy. So, hey, who decided this?
Exactly.
So you get back to Germany, and then what's your next assignment after Germany?
So we got back to Germany. As you can imagine, there was a huge backlog of PCS. So the rule was everybody had to, you know, wait your turn, go out in order. So that extended us by about, I want to say, almost another year. So it was close to, you know, 4 years in Germany, just shy of 4 years in Germany, which we didn't mind. It was a good time. But left Germany and was convinced that I was going to go back to Fort Rucker to the advanced course and, you know, play a little golf, learn a little bit about, you know, aviation doctrine. But, you know, coming right out of war, who could tell me about doctrine? I mean, I just survived it. You know, I needed to, you know, teach the doctrine. I'm just playing. But anyway, one of my squadron S3 gave me a piece of paper and said, here. And it was back then, it was called a dream sheet.
Yep.
And it's a little bubble form that you fill out, you know, for your next assignment. And on it, it said Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I'm like,
huh.
Why Fort Knox, Kentucky?
That was armored, right?
Yeah, that was where the home of the armor school was. He goes, this is where you're going. It's the best advanced course in the United States Army. They're masters at combined arms doctrine, and this is where you're going. And I'm like, I don't think so. I think I'd like to go back to Fort Rucker. And it was one of those shut up and tell her type of moment. And so we wound up going to Fort Rucker, of which I actually had to send Lachelle ahead of me by about, I think it was two and a half months. I don't think it was that, but maybe a month and a half, because she was 7.5 months pregnant with our son.
So living in Radcliffe, Kentucky. And Fort Knox.
Yeah, old Radcliffe, Kentucky. We actually got a house on post.
Yeah. Which was not great back then.
No, it wasn't great. We did have a little bit of a cockroach infestation. Other than that, you know, things were beautiful. You know, you never like to see your son's crib, you know, with cockroaches, you know, all around it. But no, all good. And that was looking back on it, that was a tremendous experience. I did not enjoy that. That was a lot of studying, and I had to eat a lot of humble pie during that course, thinking coming out of an ACR, you know, being a first lieutenant promotable master of combined arms doctrine. They taught me a few things, but it was a tremendous experience. And from there, I got to go down to Fort Campbell. So short move from, you know, Fort Knox to Fort Campbell, all in the same state, and jump right back into the CAV squadron, although quite differently from a armored community to a light infantry community.
Yep.
And they say the only difference is that your finger can only trace a map so fast when you're supporting the infantry, but traces a map much faster when you're supporting, you know, the armored force mobility, which is much more mobile, if you will. Well, not only that, it was the Army's only air assault division. That is a whole nother doctrine in and of itself. And they were masters at it. So that opened up the aperture to not only combined arms doctrine to, you know, Army aviation doctrine of supporting the ground force, the infantry force, really is the bedrock of what Army aviation was founded upon, is supporting those ground forces. And we all know that, you know, the helicopter force came to be as early as the Korean War, but greatly made its place in history in the Vietnam War.
Yeah, let me throw the reference out there. Yeah, just for those folks of you who might not be familiar with what John's talking about, is We Were Soldiers with Mel Gibson. So the pretty amazing movie. I don't know how this roots your end, John, but from me as a history buff, but a novice in that world, I thought it was pretty spectacular.
A tremendous movie that was portrayed very accurately. I actually got to know, his correspondent, who was his right hand, his co-author. He just passed a couple of years ago. Why can't I think of him? It'll come back to me. But famous war correspondent. I actually got to know him quite well when I was a CAV squadron commander out at Fort Carson, Colorado. And it was actually while they were publishing their sequence, Joe Galloway. There
yep.
you go. Joe Galloway.
He was in the
I'm
movie.
Sorry.
Yep.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely.
Yeah.
Please forgive me, Joe. But was actually out in Colorado, sequestered with General Moore at the time, finishing up the sequel to the book of We Were Soldiers Once and Young.
Okay.
But tremendous movie, and listening to him tell their stories and watching the documentary of both of them returning to Vietnam and walking the grounds of the I-Dring and LZ X-ray, and actually walking it with the North Vietnamese commander that opposed them. I mean, how unreal is that?
Yeah. You never think that could happen in a million years, Sergio.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I don't see us doing that anytime soon in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah, no, me either. So you're at Fort Campbell, and we're going to fast forward a little bit for time. How do you find yourself in the special operations community?
I got to back up to my time in Germany. Yeah. And shortly after we came home from Desert Storm, there were these posters posted up around the airfield, and it said recruiting briefing. And it said, I can't remember the exact words, but, you know, task force 160th recruiting pitch or whatever. And I was like, that looks pretty cool. I, you know, ain't got nothing else to do. So, you know, I'll hang around and, see what they got to say. And there were two guys that showed up. Bob Ritter was one, and then I can't remember Jones's first name, but he was the recruiting officer, a commission guy and a warrant officer. And the warrant officer had a massive, massive mustache. And I know it's superficial of me. And I was like, he really wears that mustache very well. And if any unit allows someone to have a mustache mm-hmm. like that, and I will admit, we all had nice mustaches in Desert Storm.
Yeah.
Even our regimental commander, Colonel Holder at the time, grew a nice mustache. But believe me, they came off shortly yeah. after we got home.
Arlen wanted one of those Robin Hood mustaches.
Exactly. So I went to this briefing and I was like, this unit sounds pretty cool. And I didn't know anything about it and actually started asking around about it and said, yeah, those guys, you know, they did Grenada and they were formed it as late as 1981. And as a result of the failed hostage rescue attempts out of Iran. So I dig a little digging, which, you know, there was not much public source information back then, but digging by asking questions and all that, and found out that they were at Fort Campbell. And actually the neighborhood that we moved in, I was surrounded by night stalkers. And when I commanded a cav troop in the 101st 217, some of my very close neighbors around me were night stalkers and had deployed out to Operation Gothic Serpent, which was Somalia at the time, the infamous Black Hawk Down scenario. And, you know, Lachelle knew their wives, and sometimes we were in the notification chains, and while they were gone, we would, you know, help the wives out, cut grass, do what we could about that. But and it became even more intriguing about this unit. And so I decided, you know, and this is still heavily debated between Lachelle and I as to, you know, how or why I wound up in the 160th. But yeah, it turned out good that I made it, I guess. Went over there and did a little staff time. Was fortunate enough to serve in both the Little Bird Gun Company and command the Little Bird Assault Company, which is not common that most people do that. Usually you get to one aircraft and you stick to it. Just so happened that the guy leaving the Little Bird Assault Company left a little bit earlier than he was supposed to, and the battalion commander selected me to command that company. And I can't say anything other than I still sit in amazement today of what people can make helicopters do and make it look relatively easy. And I will tell you that is why there's only one 160th. Because in line with the soft truth, you can't mass produce special operations forces because it takes a lot of time and very good equipment and a lot of time to make, you know, pilots that good. And these guys were and still are that good.
Hey, John, for the viewers who might not know what a little bird is, can you give it a little bit of a color?
I've historically described them as the Magnum PI aircraft.
Yeah.
It's basically the grandson of the OH-6 that was used in Vietnam. But what's unique about it, Lloyd, is that the 160th is the only unit that still fields these aircraft. So basically, they're civilian aircraft. McDonnell Douglas, of which Boeing owns them now, but an MD-530 variant. And we, being the special operations community, have say-so in how it is modified and then delivered to the unit ready for operations.
And so the 160th is known as the Night Stalkers. Can you give a little bit of flavor why it's called the Night Stalkers?
Yeah, because if we had a choice, everything that we do would be at night. because obviously when you fly around in that environment, you're protected by the darkness. And if you master, you know, that form of flight, usually you have a great advantage over the enemy. You know, does that mean we don't fight during the day? Obviously the enemy has a vote on things, but I would say 99%+ of the operations that the regiment conducts are all at night.
Okay. Now moving on. So between the time you got selected for the unit to the Bin Laden raid, can you kind of fill in the gap there of what went on with your career?
Sure. I left the regiment in 2000, having to go to Command and General Staff College because I had actually deferred a year so I could stay in command of my Little Bird Assault Company. Went to Fort Leavenworth, and the way it worked back then, although I was technically key development qualified, in other words, branch qualified, in the eyes of the big army, they wanted you to have S3 or XO time, operations or executive officer time. And there was little to no chance that I would return to the regiment just because of timing and just because of, you know, the people who are already slotted to be in those positions. So at the time, General Del Daley, who was in command of Joint Special Operations Command at the time and was the senior aviator, still senior aviator and night stalker and de facto personnel assignments officer, he had somewhat of a say-so in where the field grade officers go and what they do. He said, JT, you need to go to Fort Bragg. We're going to put you in the 82nd, get you S3 XO time, and then pull you right back into the community over here at JSOC. I'm like, no problem, sir. Sounds like a plan. So we go to Bragg, and a few months after that, I think we show up to Bragg in June or July of 2001. And we all know what happened in September of 2001. So I found myself deploying out with the 82nd Aviation Brigade to Afghanistan in OEF-1. Did 7 months, I believe, as a assault battalion S3. Came back. The Aviation Brigade was scheduled for a quick turnaround to go to Iraq, because in March of 2003, the invasion to Iraq happened, as we all remember. But General Daley needed me over at JSOC. So there was a little bit of conventional and special operations back and forth back then. But General Daley won the day, got me over into JSOC. I stayed in JSOC for 3+ years and served under him and General McChrystal at the time. And again, talking about a fire hose learning experience and being there in the early days of General McChrystal building what the book now is known as the Team of Teams, and having been a part of that was just unbelievably educational, unbelievably frightening at times because of some of the things the community was doing at the time, not just in Iraq and Afghanistan, but in other parts of the world. And I got to be on the front row of it. And it was an amazing experience.
Wow. So so what was the next step after that?
Next step after that was battalion command. I was selected for battalion command, and the way the special operations community normally works is you have to command in the conventional army before you command a special operations unit, with a couple of exceptions, and we won't get into the nuances of that, of some of the battalions in the 160th. But so I commanded fourth squadron, 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. But that's a whole nother story, because it was probably 8 months before I was scheduled to take command. I was sitting in Afghanistan and actually got a phone call from Colonel H.R. McMaster at the time, and congratulating me on my command, and then subsequently asking me, how quickly can you be here? And I was like, well, where's here, sir? I mean, he goes, well, it in Iraq. And I'm like, I'm a little confused here. So he didn't get into many of the details, but, you know, the things weren't working out with the current squadron commander, with the current aviation squadron commander. And there was a plan that we were going to do, not necessarily a change of command, but I was going to assume command in theater in Iraq, which, as an Army rule, was said, none of that will happen. But here again, this is H.R. McMaster. He somehow works this stuff, you know, and people scratch their head, but he's that persuasive, and he was that good, and he still is that good. But anyway, well, I told him, I said, hey, I'm in Afghanistan. I probably need to go home and tell Lachelle that I'm going over to Iraq for however long of a time. And, you know, so he goes, yeah, do that, and we'll talk to you here in a little bit. So I literally go home, and I get a call again, and it was our personal assignments officer, but it wasn't on the special ops side. It was on the conventional side. And he goes, hey, your aircraft transition to OH-58Ds starts in so-and-so. And I'm like, I didn't apply, you know, I didn't, he goes, yeah, but you need one, right? You're going to command 43ACR. I'm like, yeah, that's true. I'm like, but it's a 16-week course. He goes, yeah, I know, but that's, we're going to work all that out. And I'm like, well, what's going on? So anyway, I wind up having to go back to Fort Rucker, and probably 2 weeks into the course, I get summoned to the CG's office, me and both my IP, and the CG looks at my IP and basically says, how quickly can you get them through the course? And he looks at me, and I look at him, and I look at the CG, and I'm like, what do you want me to say? I'm like, listen, basically it's an OH-58. I know how to fly it, but this particular aircraft has a lot of buttons on it. And so I got to know which buttons to push
and which not to push,
you know, what not to push and all that. So, you know, basically I went through, I think the ground course was like 4 to 6 weeks, and the flying portion was, you know, 10 to 12. I did the whole thing in 6 or 7 weeks, you know, and then went back home. It was approaching Christmas of 05 and was ready to deploy. And sure enough, this man called McMaster somehow tracks me down again and says, you ready? And I'm like, yes, sir, I'm ready. And he goes, well, things are pretty calm over here. And when's the last time you spent Christmas at home? And I'm like, well, sir, it doesn't matter. You know, he goes, well, it does matter. He goes, get over here, you know, as soon as you can after New Year's, you know, in 06. And I'm like, oh, okay, how am I supposed to do that? You know, because I didn't know where to go. Well, I did have my old command, which was spread across all over Iraq. So I hitched a ride with JSOC, because I was still physically at Fort Bragg, got a ride over there and found my way, hopscotched all the way up to Sykes, which was Talafer, just to the west of Mosul, which they were a headquartered. Stayed there for about 3.5-4 more months before we redeployed back to Fort Carson. Actually was able to move the family to Fort Carson. stayed there without any resemblance of a headquarters because the ACR had since moved to Fort Hood and now Fort Calvados. I can't remember the name, the new name now, but this week.
Yeah.
But, and was able to stay there for about a year. And then sure enough, was came up on the deployment order again to take the unit back down range, of which we had been recently reflagged 1st Squadron, 6th Cavalry, 1st Infantry Division over at Fort Riley, Kansas. And then took the unit back down range for 15 months after that. So I fortunately or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, got to spend a little over 3 years in squadron command. But 2/3 of that was downrange deployed. But it was, again, you know, a tremendous experience. And I was thoroughly exhausted at the end of that. And so the Army rewarded me to go to Carlisle for a year and sort of turn off mentally, but not so much to not be able to pass Army War College. And then took command of the regiment in the summer of 2010.
Wow, summer of 2010. All right.
Yeah.
So let's see. Let's fast forward it to the I know you got a call.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what you got from McRaven.
March 17th, 2011. As I said in my presentation to Vetlanta, it was my 73 days of the Bin Laden mission. And the reason I gave it that title is because of, you know, the timing in which various people found out about that mission. And as I mentioned, as does Admiral McRaven in his book, Sea Stories, the intel community discovered the Abbottabad compound in around September of the year prior in 2010. Studied it for several months and wound up bringing it to other national leadership, to include the Pentagon leadership, in January of 2011. And that's when Admiral McRaven found out, and he and a few other planners studied that. They did some, you know, very high-end wargaming as to how best to execute a target like this, as did other services and other intel community capabilities. And that's when he brought it to a few more planners, namely myself and the SEAL commander, as to, you know, what had been going on. And then we in turn hand chose a few of the lead planners that would really peel this onion back, so to speak. And as we would bring in the actual assault force, both helos and ground force to include, we would have that much time to prepare in various scenarios before we deployed out to the mission.
So talk about that call. So because that's what I remember from your speech you gave.
Yeah. The call came when I was actually at Fort Bragg, and I guess he thought I was at Fort Campbell, but I was at Fort Bragg visiting my other headquarters, my resource headquarters, Army Special Operations Command, and he asked where I was. And I said, well, sir, I actually happen to be sitting here at Fort Bragg. He goes, well, can you drop by? And I said, absolutely, I can drop by. So come in, go over to his quarters, and greeted at the door by him. And I see George Ann, his lovely wife, who's always as gracious as can be. And I remember a plate of cookies sitting there on the kitchen table. And, you know, one, rarely do you get told to come over to your boss's house, you know, and it's usually for one or two reasons, you know, some good or some very bad. And I'm, you know, obviously racking my head as to, you know, how I've jacked something up here recently.
What did I do?
And yeah, exactly. What did I do? And why is he going to fire me over cookies? So anyway, I sit down at the kitchen table. He's in another room doing something. And I'm sitting there looking at cookies. And I'm like, well, if I'm going to get fired, I'm going to get fired on a full stomach. You know, so I start munching on cookies. And but anyway, he comes in and he tells me point blank. He goes, the intel community thinks they've found bin Laden. And I remember pausing and looking at him like, you know, it was almost like, what you talking about, Willis? You know, one of them type of moments, you know, and also, you know, thinking this is just a crock of you know what, because we've been there, done that. Yeah. And it's been several, you know, spin ups, go get them. He's not there kind of events. So we talked a little bit more. He told me how compelling what he had seen was. And, you know, I've never known him to be a BSer, especially about something like this, and would definitely not tell his units if there was nothing there. And so, like I said, told us to choose our planners, that we did. And we started meeting on a regular basis, but had to maintain a somewhat sense of business as usual as much as we could. That was a very deliberate effort, if you will, and tricky also because of, you know, the frequency of which people deployed and redeployed to that theater. Oh, by the way, we had both theaters still going at that time.
So backing it up a little bit, because I got to ask you this.
Yeah.
You're at McCrane and Towns. You just had some milk and cookies. And I imagine it was milk. It could have been coffee. So there we are. You leave. What's your first stop? Do you stop at like Wawa to get like some dip? You know, what was your first action you took? I wanted to ask you that before.
My first action is, well, I can't tell anybody, so what do I do? And, you know, in every person that I wanted to tell, I had to go back and ask Mother May I permission to tell. So I obviously left there with two or three people in mind and basically had somehow got the message to them to, you know, meet me in my office back at Campbell whenever I got back there, because I think I was scheduled to be there for a couple of more days, but obviously cut the trip short, flew back to Fort Campbell and brought my two lead planners in and basically told them, you know, exactly what Admiral McCraven had told me. They too gave me the, you know, really look. And I'm like, yeah, really. So, you know, we got to spin up a planning cell. And again, we had to give the business as usual look as much as we could. So believe it or not, that played into the people that we chose, you know, to participate in the mission. Now, don't get me wrong. I didn't, you know, there weren't more qualified pilots or lesser qualified pilots, you know, during my selection. I knew exactly who I wanted to lead the mission. So I had time enough to make it out to where, you know, they would be gone on a regular training mission. It's not like they had just deployed or they had just redeployed and, you know, I was sending them back. That would have raised concern or that would have raised questions, because I couldn't even tell my battalion commanders.
Wow.
I mean, I couldn't even read them on. I mean, it was that compartmentalized up to a point. And even through execution, I was amazed, absolutely amazed at how well this was kept secret all the way up through execution.
Hey, one of the questions I ask, and I'm kind of naive on it, and for my more Navy SEAL friends I have, please don't throat choke me or when you see me next, but why were the SEALs chosen over Delta Force to do this mission?
Yeah, that will always be discussed as to why the so-called premier hostage rescue strike force that the nation turns to, that being, you know, the unit of Fort Bragg, was not chosen after this. And there was a very rational, deliberate reason for that. And I totally, not that he needed my support, but I totally understood Admiral McRaven's thought process as he went through it. And that when Afghanistan kicked off, you can imagine it was all hands on deck from a counterterrorism perspective. So there were enough missions to go around for every special operator and more, you know, out there. But given that Iraq was the priority, if you will, from a national leadership perspective, one of those forces out of Fort Bragg was given primary responsibility of that AOR, and the unit out of Virginia was given the theater around Afghanistan of, you know, primarily. You know, still there were bits and pieces of each other in both theaters, but when you divide your command up, you obviously have subordinate headquarters that are in charge of, you know, certain pieces of terrain. And of course, you have other units within the Joint Special Operations Command construct that were given areas of responsibility as well. But at this particular time, the most experience in that particular terrain happened to be the SEALs who had been operating over there, you know, pretty much since day one.
And these guys weren't foreign to the Night Stalkers, right? I mean, you have trained with them and did operational missions.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And that's what a lot of people don't understand or comprehend, is that, you know, where there is three major ground forces, you know, that are comprised within the Joint Special Operations Command, there's basically one, you know, aviation support, you know, unit, and that's the Night Stalkers. So the level of familiarity that we have with, you know, Bragg, Virginia, and, you know, the Ranger Regiment is immense across all three of those. I mean, we are in essence one operational unit. So it's not as if we only operate with these during this time and we only operate with those. It is everybody all the time. Now, is that metered? You know, yes, obviously, because like I said, there's only one of us, you know, and with limited resources, but we're immensely familiar with each other's operations, and dating pre-9/11, that was the intent of the Holloway Commission and why the task force was formed even back in October of 1981, was for continuity of support across all of special operations.
Okay. So you've got the planners, you've planned it, you've hired the crews, you've built the compound, you've practiced it, and now it's time to execute it. So you're landing this, but you're not flying it, and I know you wanted to fly it.
Right.
So during execution, were you in country or were you in the U.S.?
I was in country, and it's a little comical the way Admiral McRaven puts it in his book and all that, because typically the 160th Regimental Commander is not a warfighter. My battalion commanders were four deployed, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were the four commanders of the rotary wing air component that was supporting. But because this was so highly sensitive and classified, and to, again, not draw any unnecessary attention away from the current fight, I did tell him. But I suggested to Admiral McRaven, as did the SEAL commander, that we should oversee. We should be your air mission commanders and ground force commanders that are located in the JOC during this, to again let the remainder of our forces continue the fight, the other fight, of which there was. I mean, this was during the so-called surge in Afghanistan, where they had brought in, you know, I want to say close to 100,000 more troops, you know, because of everything going on. So it fit nicely that myself and the SEAL commander could fulfill those roles in the JOC in Afghanistan at the time. And I had been in country several times. I tried to go over there at least once a quarter, both in Afghanistan and Iraq and a couple other places where my forces were deployed. So it's not like I hadn't been in country in years. Matter of fact, I think I was there probably, you know, 3 or 4 months prior to that, just on normal battlefield circulation trip, you know, just to see how everybody was. But yeah, so we were there in the JOC, which was another sort of miracle in and of itself, because we took a room that was, I don't know, it probably 12 feet wide and 20 feet long, and made it into this, you know, operational center that was about to command and control, you know, the largest, most secretive mission, you know, probably since, you know, the Doolittle raid.
Yeah, that's
or at least the Sante raid. You know, so
that's amazing. Everybody kind of visualizes this, what's getting ready to happen. You think of Zero Dark 30, the movie, and I know they got some of the stuff right. They got a lot of the stuff wrong. I think one of the things they got wrong is, you know, they made it seem like it was only a total of 4 air assets. And I'm sure there was a significant of iron in there for sure.
There was. And, you know, with the lead force going in on the 2 Blackhawks, we never, ever, ever would launch on a mission without the capability of a QRF that could quickly respond to that. And we had additional assets positioned to not only provide a QRF capability, but also to provide needed fuel if and when the primary assault aircraft, Blackhawks, would need it just to get out of country. And it wound up, they did need it to come back. Although, you know, the pilot told me they could have made it. And I'm saying, well, I mean, no harm, no foul, no blood. Yeah. So, you know, it was good that we did stop to make sure if we did have to execute a contingency coming out of country, that we had the needed fuel on board.
So your mindset, so you're the heroes are getting ready to launch, and I can assume you were confident but nervous. Can you walk us through that mindset a bit?
Yeah, and Admiral McRaven talks about, you know, visiting each force shortly before launch. He talks about, you know, going to visit the ground force, who was, you know, gathered around, just sort of having a kumbaya moment, if you will. There was a small adjacent building off of the JOC to where I had gathered the air crews. And he talked about and reemphasized the fact that what we're about to do does not differ, or is relatively no different than, the same types of missions that we have been performing for the 10 previous years. And that is, you know, a basic raid. You know, you plan your mission, you contingency it to death, you load the aircraft, you hit the LZ, you conduct your mission, you get back on the aircraft, and you come home. in a very macro nutshell, I mean, that's what we had been doing for 10 years in Afghanistan, in the most challenging aviation environment that you can think of. And that's what he wanted to leave with, you know, both the air crews and the ground force said, listen, this is simple. Forget the fact that this is probably the Super Bowl of all missions that you have and probably will ever perform in your career, you know, but the fact is, it's no different than what you did last week. You know, you planned it, you contingencied it to death, you put the crew on the X where they were supposed to be, and you came back in and got them, and everybody, you know, got the heck out of Dodge and came home. It's really that simple, you know. Now, throw in the fact that it's in a so-called allied nation that, you know, really doesn't trust us and we don't trust them. And they have somewhat of a, you know, IAD system, a integrated air defense system that we have to somewhat avoid. And the fact that this particular building sits only half or three quarters of a mile from their equivalent of a West Point and a infantry battalion garrison, you know, forget all that. Yeah. Get in there, put the assaulters on the ground, you know, wait for them to do the mission, come back in, pick them up, and come home.
So, John, from the time the two helos departed to the time they arrived back, how long of a time duration was that?
We were planned to be on target for 30 minutes, and that was bumping up to the very limits of the gas we needed to get out of country. They were actually on target for 38 minutes. Oh, by the way, we had to, you know, fly the crew of Chalk One out as well on the QRF aircraft that responded to Chalk One conducting a forced landing in the western edge of the Abbottabad compound. And because of the immense amount of intel and hard drives, floppy disk, computers, you name it, that was found within the compound, you know, they requested the extra time. And knowing that we had the flexibility to get gas on the way out, we pushed it out to 38 minutes. And they flew out on, you know, Chalk 2 of the lead assault aircraft, and then one of the 47s that came in with the QRF.
So how long was that flight, or are you allowed to say?
We called it the fish hook. I think it was, I want to say about an hour and 20 minutes flight. Wow. I think.
Yeah, that's significant.
Close to.
Yeah. And I like to talk about mindset. You're in the operations center, and you hear, you're listening to it live time, and you get the, you hear it going down, the special Blackhawk that did the forced landing. What was it like in that op center when that happened?
I would like to tell you that, you know, it was absolutely seamless. And for the most part, it was, because believe it or not, that contingency that actually was executed was practiced more than the base plan was, because we were convinced that the lead aircraft would either be fired upon or, you know, have difficulty during the initial assault for a number of reasons. The fact that they were probably no less than, you know, 50 feet outside of the third story balcony of where, you know, bin Laden wound up being located, we were sure that the aircraft would receive some type of fire from either inside or outside the compound upon approach. Turns out that that wasn't the case. And what had happened is that there's a aerodynamic phenomena out there called settling with power. And the compound walls ranged between 12 and 18 feet around the compound. And the fact that we were trying, or Chalk One was trying to get as low as possible so that the ground force would not be exposed for a long time while roping down onto the ground of the compound, the aircraft started to fly in what we refer to as dirty air, and it started losing lift. Because of that, the lead pilot knew exactly what to do. They were going, you know, 30, 40, 50 feet, whatever it was, directly off the nose and landed in the animal pen that they used to store their animals. Well, you know, the aerodynamic effect on an aircraft, when it loses lift, it starts to spin. And the way you fly out of that, or the way you get out of that, is to nose the aircraft over and find clean air. Well, the pilots knew that we could not waste time with what's called a go-around, because that would allow, you know, even more people to become even more alert as to what we were doing. So he did what was called a controlled crash into the animal pen, and I jokingly probably put it down, you know, softer than he would a normal assault landing, compared to what, how some of them would land in Afghanistan.
All right. Wow. And so now it's exceptional. All the books and movies and biographies and documentaries have seen, just remarkable to see the story and hear the story. Now they make it back and they identify the body. They transfer it out to the aircraft carrier for burial at sea. What's the mindset of your folks? Because you saw that, you know, the CIA agent who was actually multiple people, you saw her mindset, you know, was kind of like relief. And I guess the actual thing that person said is she's now unemployed. She's out of a job. But for you and your folks, what was the mindset immediately afterwards?
Obviously, there was a little bit of celebration when they were back on the ground there in Afghanistan at the base we launched out of. But we knew that the mission writ large was far from over. And the turnover of the remains was another challenge. Not for me personally, but something that, you know, that I obviously had a sideline seat on as to, you know, what were going to happen with Bin Laden's remains. And listening to, you know, phone calls between, you know, us being, you know, at Admiral McRaven, the White House, Department of State, DOD, and the intel community was quite fascinating in the level of speed that things happened when we were trying to figure out what we're going to do with the remains. In the meantime, my guys, I said, okay, we need to get back to Bagram and still keep as low profile as possible, which made it very hard to do when we turned on the news and we saw people gathering outside the White House and running through the streets of Washington, D.C., chanting USA, USA,
yeah.
Which what was an amazing experience, but we're like, we're not even out of country yet.
Yeah.
So I'm about to cut us some slack here. But anyway, so we got all that done, still sifting through. Not us personally, but watching the intel gang sift through the mounds and mounds of stuff that was brought off the target, knowing that that's going to take quite a while, in trying to find immediate type of intel. Not sure, you know, to what level that came about, but I think we all got back to Fort Campbell. I actually got to fly back with Admiral McRaven and the senior leadership in his plane out of country. And we were back in the States within 10, 12 hours of mission completion.
Really? Oh, I did not know. Yeah. Wow. So I can't imagine what the conversation was with Lachelle.
It was something because, you know, although, like I said, I tried to maintain a business as usual as much as I could. There were a few things during the whole planning sequence of it that pulled me away. The one was during an actual formal I was supposed to be at and accept an award that was pulled out of that to go up to DC. And she was like, "Where are you going?" I'm like, "I'll be back in a little bit," you know. But she knew something was going on during that time frame. Admiral Raycraven mentioned it in his book, as well as I think I mentioned in my presentation. Libya happened to be spinning up at the same time, and that was around the same time that Gaddafi was taken out. So that provided a convenient cover story during the lead up to it. But obviously, when POTUS, President Obama, came out and made the announcement that, you know, the proverbial cat's out of the bag during that time, and it was all hugs and kisses and probably a few expletives, you know, when I got home.
So have you been to Abbottabad?
Had I been?
No, have you been since?
No.
Not on your bucket list?
No, it's not a vacation spot yet. It'd be pretty cool. And I had actually had the opportunity to do some pretty unique stuff in Pakistan while I was at JSOC under the direction of General McChrystal to help stand up LNOs while we were over there. And it was actually a member of my unit, a member of the Fort Bragg unit, and a member of the Virginia unit that went over there and was able to brief senior leadership on who we are, what we do, and what we would like to do. And, you know, got to travel a good bit, but never went up north to that extent. Was mostly out toward the border and toward the 11th Frontier Corps AOR.
Well, I think you and real John Phillips need to do a weekend road trip. Or try to we can get in.
Yeah, we wouldn't blend in too well.
I don't think so. So although we all have bibs.
Who knows? Exactly. Who knows? Maybe one day. I don't know. I won't hold out hope that you know, we won't be able to tour the battlefields of World War II or Afghanistan or Iraq, much like we did in World War II, and be able to talk about the good old times.
Yep, time flies for sure. So crazy.
It does. Yeah. It's amazing. We did do a very small, non highly advertised 10-year reunion a few years ago up in DC, and it was good to see a lot of the guys that participated in the mission, mostly from my unit. There were a few guys from the ground force that showed up, but yeah, you gotta wonder. I don't know if we'll be like, you know, the Doolittle Raiders that, you know, had their own jackets and all that, and the hats and celebrated 25, 30, 40, 50 years of that. Who knows? I don't know.
It's neat, John. Well, thank you for sharing your story. And you know, I'm honored you're a friend, not because of all the cool things you've done. I'm honored you're a friend because of the heart that you took into those cool things you've done. So I think that speaks largely to the character and the man you are.
Well, thank you, Lloyd, and thank you for your service. You know, we talk often about my favorite aircraft flying around when I was a little bird guy was a Starlift or a 141. I mean, you guys never left us stranded or anything like that. And the work you do with veterans in and around Atlanta is nothing short of astounding. No better friend to the veteran than Lloyd Knight.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the John, and I'm going to end the Tango Tango podcast like I end all my podcasts. Be safe, be kind, and be remarkable.
The Tango Tango podcast is proudly sponsored by Supply Chain Now. Join the Tango Tango community for more inspiring stories. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn. Subscribe to the Tango Tango YouTube channel and follow and listen to Tango Tango wherever you get your podcasts.